This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the volatile situation at the United States Postal Service. Nancy Pelosi called House leaders back into session for a special vote this past weekend, and Louis DeJoy and Donald Trump are feeling the heat of public outrage.
We speak today with Ajamu Baraka, whose understanding is that social change comes from below. He was the 2016 vice presidential candidate of the Green Party. He's a leader of the Black Alliance for Peace, a contributor to Black Agenda Report, and an activist in the Black is Back Coalition.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. As we've been reporting on Law and Disorder, the new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, a staunch Trump supporter, has wasted no time enacting such changes at the post office as ending overtime pay and even removing some sorting machines. Not surprisingly, these changes have created great delays in service across the nation. In response, the White House Chief of Staff has indicated openness to providing emergency funding to help the Postal Service deal with a surge in mail-in ballots. DeJoy now says these changes will not occur until after the election. But his significant and personal financial interest in the Postal Service's corporate rivals and contractors leave many doubting his credibility. The November election is expected to bring in up to 80 million ballots by Americans nervous about in-person voting because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Postal Service notified states in July that it might not be able to meet their deadlines for delivering last-minute mail-in ballots. Donald Trump has unabashedly criticized mail voting as vulnerable to fraud. At the same time, he himself requested an absentee ballot from his new home state of Florida. For an update on this ever-developing story, we speak once again to Chuck Zlatkin, legislative director of the New York Metro Area Postal Union. Chuck, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me back.
If there were any doubts that Donald Trump was trying to dismantle the USPS and interfere with the upcoming election, those are gone. Now, Louis DeJoy has reversed course and says that no changes will occur until after the election. The question is, do you trust him?
Well, I don't trust him only because what he says and what he does are not necessarily the same thing. Of course, at this point, he's, you know, under the microscope and lots of scrutiny. But again, him delaying the changes till after the election doesn't mean that he's not going to go ahead and destroy the post office after the election. Concern about the ballots, well, that's another thing, and he's had to respond to that. But I would never trust him, but a lot of people are watching what he's doing now. Not just the postal workers.
Chuck, is it possible for him to reinstall the sorting machines that I understand were removed and put back some of the boxes outside postal offices that he took away?
Well, you know, I guess it's possible to put the machines back, but it won't happen because the ones that have been removed, as far as I know, have been dismantled. And I guess if you wanted to put the people behind it and the money to do it, it's possible, but I don't think that's planned. I think what he will do is stop taking out machines, maybe the ones in certain facilities where they hadn't yet taken the machines out, they basically stopped using them. They might, you know, return those to service, but these are massive machines, and I think that he probably won't do that.
Chuck, tell us about some of DeJoy's conflicts of interest with private sector mail services.
It's quite a story here, the more you look into it. And we're not financial analysts, but to follow DeJoy, I guess you become one. But between he and his wife, with the former a company which he owned new breed that became XPO, and he had lots of stock and then also options and investments in that company. That's the one where they say between $30 million and $75 million. That's a postal contractor. They do logistics work for the post office and have for some time the Joy. But in addition to that, he also owned between $265,000 and $550,000 in UPS stock, a direct competitor to the Postal Service. But the story is that after he was made the Postmaster General, divested those shares. He also owned shares in J.B. Hunt, the trucking company, which is also both a competitor and a contractor at times of the Postal Service. You know, I think he had a hundred and something thousand dollars in that. The interesting thing is that he also owned stock in Amazon, and that he had, in the financial disclosures, he had owned between $100,000 and $250,000 in Amazon stock when he joined the administration. On June 24th, which is after he became postmaster, he divested those shares. But the same day that he divested the shares, he bought between $50,000 and $100,000 in stock options for Amazon. And the stock options, I mean, expire sometime in October, but it gives the Joy the ability to buy shares in Amazon at a price of something like $1,900 a share, and Amazon is currently trading at more than $3,100 a share. So he divested, but he bought futures, which will serve him very well. So he has no problem whatsoever in making money along the way, and it really didn't bother him that he was taking on a position as Postmaster General of the United States, supposedly in an apolitical, nonpartisan manner, but that he was still owning stocks and contractors and competitors of the Postal Service, and then as that came to light, you know, then he was like, you know, forced to make moves. But even now, clearly you can see that he has a vested interest in what the Postal Service does, that he's not necessarily doing what's best for the people he serves or the Postal Service itself, because he's got his own financial stakes involved.
The self-serving behavior, both of DeJoy but also of Donald Trump, who has admitted that he is purposely denying funds to make voting by mail as difficult as possible, is rather astonishing. I'm not sure which one is more reprehensible. Do you think Trump is going to continue to disparage mail-in ballots as fraudulent, even when there is no evidence to support that?
Well, he's been doing it all along with no evidence. It's always dangerous to try and predict what Trump's going to do or what's in his mind. Personally, I don't want to go in his mind. I'm afraid to do that. But nothing would surprise me. So at the same time he's coming out disparaging, he then tweets, you know, save the Postal Service. So it's really hard to understand what's going on, but within his mind what he's intending to do. But it is interesting because originally our concerns and the people who concerned about having a public postal service was maintaining, you know, the postal service through the pandemic crisis and also making sure that it would exist for generations to come. And that meant that it needed funding. Now it's become focused on just mail and voting for the November election. It's not good enough. Maybe it was even just, you know, shifting people's attention away from the basic fact, because now people think, well, it's a victory now. They're not going to mess with the mail-in balloting. They're not going to, you know, destroy the post office until, you know, January next year. That's not good enough for us.
That's a very good point. And we are taping this program several days before the House is poised to vote on a financial relief bill. If they do vote to provide financial relief, I don't recall the numbers. How long would assistance from the government help the survival of the post office?
Okay, well, again, I'm not really clear what they're voting on in the House at this point because they already had passed $25 billion in relief as part of the HEROES package, which went nowhere. I don't know of a standalone bill because, again, what they first were going down there to was to pass legislation forcing him to bring back what he had in operation to undo the changes. So I'm not necessarily sure what the House bill will look at, again, when we're taping by Saturday. He's also been brought before the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate, or at least they're going to be addressing the issue on Friday. So there'll be testimony on Friday, testimony the following Monday, and also voting on some version of the bill on Saturday. But what's needed, the $25 billion will help the Postal Service deal with the immediate loss of revenue and continue on through this pandemic crisis, assuming, you know, that when it gets back to normal, whatever that'll be, business, the Postal Service will continue to exist, even though the long-term effects financially may be deeper than that. But $25 billion will enable the Postal Service to keep functioning. And that's really important, as people have seen through this COVID-19 pandemic, how important the Postal Service has been, you know, to people in terms of getting them essential needs met and dealing with people getting their medications and receiving needed funds and also package mail. So it's still a critical time, and it's in flux. So we're hopeful, finally, the Congress will do something in both houses that they should have done a long time ago. But it's like we have to watch the joy of what he says he's going to do and what he does. We have to do the same thing with both houses of Congress. And to be frank, both parties, we have to really see what they're going to do, because there's this sense that there's been a great victory and that Trump has gotten a setback and the joy has had to change what he's going to do. But, you know, we need a postal service after November 3rd.
If you were a congressperson questioning DeJoy, what single most important question would you ask him?
Well, what I would say to him, as the logistics expert he is, and one who supposedly wants to bring efficiency to the Postal Service, how do you consider it efficient to make sure that a truck leaves on time, even though it's empty, and that if you kept it there for 10 more minutes, you could be delivering 80,000 pieces of mail? Please explain to me from your expertise why leaving an empty truck is more efficient and fulfilling your mission to have prompt, reliable, and efficient service to the American people.
Have postal workers asked for and received support from other unions?
Oh, yes, very much so. As a matter of fact, earlier on, we had asked other unions to join with us in contacting, you know, senators and legislators and asking for support. And they've come forward, including the entire New York City Central Labor Council has passed a resolution in support of the post office and calling upon their members to do what's necessary to help us out. And anytime anything is being done outside in the street, you know, other unions have shown up. So we feel that we've gotten a lot of support across the labor movement in our struggle.
And as we are recording this, lawsuits have been filed in at least 20 states. Do you think that has impacted DeJoy's perception of what he needs to do?
Well, you know, I think any time someone like DeJoy might be called under oath, whether it's in front of a House of Congress or in court, he understands that's a little different than, you know, speaking to employees or at a press conference or whatever. And also, you know, the powers of the state. I mean, we've been working with the New York State Attorney General's office. They've asked us, you know, to get whatever information we can about delays in the mail, you know, both, you know, factual and anecdotal from our employees. So, yes, I don't know of anybody who would like to be have lawsuits brought against them and being investigated by people who have subpoena power. So, yes, I think that's part of the pressure that he's fallen upon. And that, and it's also, you know, maybe having people, you know, noisily demonstrating where you live out in the streets in both Washington, D.C. and Greensboro, North Carolina, have also impacted upon him, because he's pretty much been able to, you know, only be a public figure when he wanted to be prior to becoming Postmaster General. It's a little different now.
Can you just address the issue of morale among postal workers right now? I would hope that they're heartened to a certain extent at public outcry, but this has got to be really demoralizing for them. How are the workers holding up?
That's a good question, because the postal workers have been through a time of knowing that there were people out to destroy us, privatize us, even before DeJoy came into power. Then dealing with the, you know, the pandemic itself, where, you know, postal workers or essential workers having to come to work to fulfill their job, but not knowing if they were going to get sick, if they were bringing something home to their families, and dealing with that. And then because of 40,000 workers being under quarantine, 2,500 being sick with the virus itself, 75 dying. And these all impact upon people, and people getting out to work, and postal workers were working these extraordinary hours to move the mail and get it out. You get paid overtime and you get a big check, but to do that day in, day out, week out, after a while, it becomes pretty stressful on you and having a life as well. And then the new postmaster comes in and says, oh, everything that you've worked your entire career to do, to make your priority to move the mail out, that's going to be changing now. We're going to be leaving the mail behind. And no matter how much work there is, there's not going to be any more overtime to get it done. And we're having a hiring freeze. That's extraordinarily demoralizing, because postal workers care about what they do. It's hard to do this work and not care about you when you also understand the impact that it has on people. You're seeing that you're dealing with prescription medications to people. You're seeing packages coming from the Veterans Administration with prescription medicine for veterans that you're normally is a top priority to get them to them, and now you're being told to leave them behind till tomorrow or the next day. I mean, that really is totally demoralizing. And then, of course, you know, the President of the United States calls you a joke, and that where you work is a catastrophe. I mean, all of this stuff, you know, adds up to the postal workers, you know, understand things. And they hang in there and they do the job. They were encouraged, of course, by the fact that at least DeJoy had to roll this back. And they felt that this was a victory for our unions and our allies and elected officials who understand what the circumstance is. So there was, you know, some sense of well-being in this stuff. But we know we're far from the struggle being over, and that we have to stay vigilant all the time. And make sure that while the postmaster is saying we're not going to be, you know, delaying the mail anymore, our members on the work floor and the trucks and whatever can know if this is true or not. So we've got a lot of eyes and ears out there that are watching this, who are postal workers and coming forth and giving us that information that we as a union can share as we deal with management, but also share that information with the Attorney General's office as well.
I want to underscore the issue that we cannot be complacent at this juncture, despite the positive news about lawsuits, the hearing that will have happened by the time this airs. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi apparently spoke the day we are taping this with DeJoy, and she said this. DeJoy, quote, frankly admitted that he had no intention of replacing the sorting machines, blue mailboxes, and other key mail infrastructure that had been removed, and that plans for adequate overtime, which is critical for the timely delivery of mail, are not in the works. So there's a lot of work that remains to be done.
So what is he actually going to be doing in terms of changing his plans? He's going to allow the trucks to wait before they go out empty? If he's not going to put back the machines, he's not going to put back blue boxes, and he's not going to have overtime, is he going to be hiring? I mean, it's interesting what he's doing. So, again, everybody needs to contact their senators and their representatives and let them know that this is an important issue to them, and they'll settle for nothing less than getting the prompt, efficient, and reliable mail service that the mission statement in the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970, and will accept nothing less at this, during a pandemic, at this crucial time, when people are depending on the mail service more than ever.
I mean, the actions of Trump and DeJoy are nothing short of criminal, given where we are in history. People need to be out there buying stamps, supporting the postal office. What else, as we have just a minute or so left, Chuck, can people do? Are there petitions to sign?
You can go to APWU, that's fourletters.org, and there are letters and petitions to sign, but also this is being aired tomorrow. There's been a call to have actions, demonstrations, even people holding up a sign at every post office in America. If people are willing to do that, come out there and, I guess, wear a mask and be socially distanced, but let people know that you're in support of a public postal service and you'll accept nothing less. DeJoy is a foot customer, and he's trying to finesse his way through, but hopefully when he's being questioned under oath, he won't get softball questions from the our elected officials, and he'll really have to nail it down and explain what he's doing. But it's, our mail service. It's owned by the people of this country. It's a year older than this country, and we should settle for nothing less. And let's face it, if this guy can't do the job, we need to contact the Postal Board of Governors, the six of them, the one who supposedly hired him, and say, hey, it's not only your ability to get rid of him, it's your duty to get rid of him. This guy is not doing the job. He's a disgrace to what he's supposed to be doing. Fire him and get somebody in there who respects the Postal Service and the people that we serve. My local union, the New York Metro Area Postal Union, has taken the position that DeJoy should resign or be fired. Our national hasn't gotten there yet.
Well, we like to think that New York is the standard bearer and the nation will follow. Chuck, we have to say goodbye now, but we want to thank you for everything that you're doing on behalf of USPS workers and for joining us so frequently on Law and Disorder to keep us up to date.
Well, thank you for having me, and hopefully I'll come back in time and be able to talk about, the total victory that's won, and that people can rely on having a fully funded public postal service. But somehow I'm afraid that I may have to come back to talk about the next thing that's been thrown at us. But in any event, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Politically, this is a time of great opportunity and great peril. The economic, racial, and health crises we have been put in will deepen in the coming months as the pandemic spreads, the depression gets worse, and racist police brutality does not go away. There has been a massive corporate bailout disguised as a stimulus package. It has left millions of people jobless, broke, sick, and facing homelessness. Trump and his Republican Party, venal and incompetent, have given up trying to contain the pandemic, ameliorate the economic catastrophe, or rein in the police. The Republicans left Washington 2 weeks ago, refusing to pass an economic package that would aid the unemployed, which now number over 30 million. 175,000 people have already died from COVID-19, and millions face eviction. The massive demonstrations in the streets, black-led with the support of a majority of whites, has been an insurgency unprecedented in American history. We speak today with Ajamu Baraka. He was the 2016 vice presidential candidate of the Green Party. He's a leader of the Black Alliance for Peace, a contributor to Black Agenda Report, and an activist in the Black is Back Coalition. Ajamu Baraka, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Michael. I'm really glad to be here.
Ajamu, I wanted to ask you to please share with us the influences that were active on you when you were growing up in Chicago in the 50s and the 60s. What made you into a socialist and a black nationalist and an internationalist?
Well, Michael, that's a very interesting question, and I think about that quite often. I came from a traditional black family in the sense that the family was very prideful in terms of advancing the race, if you will. Also had elements in the family that were part of the of that tradition, but also Marxist. My grandfather on my mother's side was a Marxist, a member of the U.S. Communist Party. And so that those perspectives really helped to shape how I understood my lived experiences. Growing up on the South Side of Chicago, as a member of the working class, but really, really poor. And in the sense that in the black community that I lived in, which was a working class community, my family was even poorer than the black working class. And so I got a sense of not only the issue of race, but also the issue of class, because I was in fact, and my family was in fact a victim of some class discrimination, if you will. So that shaped my perspective. And so as I became more political in the sense of connecting my lived experiences to a theoretical framework, then it helped me to not only ground my nationalism, but also ground my understanding of the structure of society in terms of the role of capital. And then understanding how capitalism in the U.S. connected to the global capitalist system. So this is the foundation for my political work when I became really political, that is, in the late 60s and early 70s. My trajectory was quite clear, going from those experiences to the black internationalist tradition that I've been grounded in ever since.
Fast forwarding, Ajamu Baraka, you joined the Green Party ticket with Jill Stein in 2016, and you said in your acceptance speech that you were joining in an effort to, I'm quoting you now, build a multinational movement here in this country based on the needs and aspirations of working people, end quote. How have things changed in the last 4 years, and is it more possible now to do this than it ever was?
You know, Michael, I think it is. With the veritable collapse of the capitalist economy, both in the U.S. and globally, the collapse of the global commodity of prices and the global supply chain, resulting in real misery on the part of millions of people, the massive unemployment here in the U.S., and the failure of the capitalist state to protect the fundamental human rights of the people of this country, and the exposure of that failure has really resulted in a process of rapid radicalization, I believe, in particular among young folks and young workers. So there seems to be a growing awareness of the nature of the system and an understanding, Michael, of the class interests represented by both of the major political parties. So I think the material basis and the ideological foundation is such where there is a real possibility of a real shift toward a more radical politics. We see that with the kinds of questions that people are raising regarding the system and the almost complete rejection on the part of large numbers of young people to the Biden-Harris ticket in the Democrat Party. So I think that there is a real possibility of progressive politics, radical politics in the U.S. that is even more likely to occur than just 4 years ago. And I think it's a development that is going to be very, very interesting in the upcoming election and even beyond that, because people are recognizing that the plight of people in this country goes beyond just the electoral cycle, and people are prepared to really think about and imagine something that goes beyond this system.
Ajamu Baraka, you're a leader of the organization Black Alliance for Peace, and I wanted to ask you about its mission. Have you written that the same way the settler colonial state used Obama to give cover to the continuation, indeed intensification, of the project to maintain white elite power globally, but unlike 2008, 2009, there are so many more today that are hip to this game and are rejecting the politics of co-optation and reaction. In BAP, we say build a real movement for democracy, people-centered human rights, and self-determination. Remember our captured prisoners, all power to the people, no compromise and no retreat in the face of neoliberal fascism. Please talk about the Black Alliance for Peace.
We launched the Black Alliance for Peace in 2017 because we recognize that the crisis of the system, the crisis of capitalism, the legitimation crisis was resulting in a more pronounced dependency on the part of the state toward the use of violence, both in the U.S. And globally. And we thought that after the 8 years of the Obama administration and the disarming of the anti-war and even the anti-imperialist movement, that we had an opportunity to revive the anti-war movement and the anti-imperialist movement in the country. But we saw that a key to that would be to revive the traditional anti-war and anti-imperialist positions of the Black community. So the Alliance was launched to, in fact, do that, to revive that tradition, to connect up an understanding of the repression that the Black community was experiencing in the U.S. And the militarization with the repression that the U.S. launches against people globally and the militarization and war that the U.S. state advances. So we took this task on to build an alliance, to organize opposition, to engage the people in political discussion, to raise consciousness, and to lay the foundation for a more effective organization, Black Left unity and the unity of the radical movement in the U.S. So this is the goal that we have been pursuing. We are in a good place today as a consequence of that work and the collapse of the economy and the fact that there are so many people now looking for explanations and for an organizational home. We are providing both of those. So the work of the Black Alliance of Peace is taking off even more so than just a few months ago. And we will continue to build and to take advantage of the fact that there are people who are ready to make a break with the system and to imagine the possibility of going way beyond what exists today.
So how do you respond to critics who say that support for independent politics like yours and like those put forward by Howie Hawkins and the Green Party, how do you respond to people who say that that'll just help Trump?
Well, you know, we have been dealing with that that so-called critique for quite some time. We say that those forces don't really understand democracy. Democracy is supposed to be the rule of the people. We say, look, if you're concerned about the Trump and Trump forces, then you should be committed to building a real democracy, creating the conditions where there can be real opposition. You know, Trump put out a tweet in response to the Michelle Obama speech, and he reminded, you know, the Democrats, and it was interesting. He said, without the policies of the Obama administration creating the conditions that they created, I'm paraphrasing, of course, there would be no Donald Trump, which is really correct. That it was neoliberal economics that created the conditions, and the failure of the Democratic Party to have to provide a democratic alternative that opened up the door to a Donald Trump. Let me say, if you want to be concerned, if you want to oppose the trajectory of Trumpism, then build a pro-democracy movement. So this notion that, you know, we have to only align with the neoliberal right in order to stop the right of Donald Trump is a position that not only is it illogical, but it is one that politically is being rejected by those social forces I referred to earlier, these young people that see that it's both parties that are the problem. Both parties are representing interests that are counter to theirs. The Green Party, I think, is well positioned on the cutting edge of this sentiment to expand itself. And Hawkins, Walker campaign and the policies that they have embraced and are advancing are more in line with the sentiment of vast numbers of people in this country than anything that we see coming from the Democrat Party. Let's remind ourselves, it was, in fact, the Green New Deal that we ran on in 2016 that was adopted, stripped of some of its more radical elements, and became the basis or the foundation for the so-called progressive movement within the Democrat Party. So it shows that with the right kind of exposure, the politics of the Green Party would take off, and that's why both parties, but the Democrats in particular, are very much concerned about not giving the Green Party any kind of national exposure.
Or giving the leftists in general any kind of national exposure. I read last week that AOC was given 1 minute to speak at the Democratic National Convention, and shockingly, she took it. I wanted to ask you about what we're talking about is really a debate about where social change comes from. The Democratic Party convention featured people of color and showcased Kamala Harris. How do you appreciate her as a candidate, and what is your criticism of identity politics?
Well, you know, this is one of the issues that the Democrat Party faces, in the sense that we consider the Democrat Party to be a white supremacist party. The white supremacist party to represent the interests of the white male capitalist minority. And they have been very adroit in using identity as a weapon to mask the class politics of the Democrat Party, and in fact, the class politics of those weaponized ethnic communities and individuals that are pushing the agenda of the white male capitalist minority. You know, Michael, I tried to steer away from this whole term of identity politics, but it's something that we can't really avoid, and we have to deal with it. The very fact that Kamala Harris is pushed as some kind of a progressive move by the Democrat Party, again, to us, just represents the corruption of the of political discourse and understanding in the U.S. And the opportunism that we see within the Democrat Party, because Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, they both represent the neoliberal wing of that party. They both represent policies and positions that are unable to speak to the realities of the working class, and specifically the black working class. But yet this ticket is framed as something that everyone is supposed to fall behind. Well, we reject that. We reject its implications, and we say again that without a movement for democracy and people-centered human rights, a move toward a socialist transformation, we're not going to be able to address the real issues that face people in this country and globally. And we are prepared to take on that struggle, that ideological and political struggle, no matter what critics might say about that.
Ajamu Baraka, you were recently part of the Black is Back Coalition, who had a conference on black political prisoners. You're a leader of the Black Alliance for Peace, and you were part of that coalition. Can you tell our audience what were some of the highlights of the Black is Back Coalition conference?
Well, for this year, we highlighted the plight of black political and third world prisoners. This is what we call Black August, which is a very important month in the black liberation movement, where the month that they assassinated George Jackson and the Attica uprising, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Attica was in September, but it was inspired by the events of August. And so we thought this was a perfect opportunity to raise up the plight of the continuation of black and third world political prisoners. The U.S. has the longest confined political prisoners on the planet, and most of these captives are part of the black liberation movement, ex-Black Panthers, ex-members of the Black Liberation Army, et cetera. And so we raised that up in this conference a few weeks ago. We raise it up as a reminder of the nature of the state, and that if we really are serious about transforming this society, we have to address the U.S. state and not have any illusions about the state and the system that the state is upholding. So that was what we raised. Some of the highlights that came out was a fantastic presentation by Glenn Ford that pull all these various elements together, and now we are moving toward a march on Washington, organized the week after the election. Because we take the position, Michael, it doesn't really matter who sits in the white people's house after the election in November, that nothing changes for the African working class and for most people around the world, because both parties are committed to upholding the colonial capitalist system, and therefore the war continues. So this conference is part of that process of organizing and mobilizing and continuing in the struggle that we have to wage in this country and globally.
What is the position of the social Democrats like Bernie Sanders on capitalism? Do they really challenge capitalism, or do they just want to reform its rougher edges?
Saw what happened with the Bernie Sanders challenge. But here we have the deepest crisis of capital since the 1930s. In the midst of the Bernie Sanders challenge to the Democratic Party, and what does Bernie Sanders do? He takes himself off the battlefield. He basically surrenders to the real anger of many of his supporters. This, I think, reflects the bankruptcy, the inability of social democrats to seize the time, because they are limited ideologically and limited politically. So I have very little respect for that tendency. One good thing that Bernie Sanders was able to do that I regard as valuable, and that is to introduce the language of class to a certain extent, to put on the table questions of socialism, to help to galvanize a whole new generation of young people to think about this system in a different kind of way. We owe that to Bernie, being able to penetrate bourgeois discourse. But beyond that, he missed the historical moment. He missed it, like we've seen so often so many other social democrats miss it, get themselves positioned to manage capital as opposed to helping the people to transcend the contradictions and realities of this backward capitalist system.
We're speaking with Ajamu Baraka, a leader of Black Alliance for Peace. Ajamu, there's a new Cold War unfolding against China, the United States against China. People are not quite aware of that. And I wanted to ask you, what is the Black Alliance for Peace doing about that? And could you talk about what the USA has in terms of its designs against China?
Well, it's quite clear that one of the accomplishments of the Trump administration over the last 3 years has been to galvanize ruling class opinion against China. You might recall that Trump wanted to make that pivot from Russia to China from the very beginning, but he faced significant opposition within certain ruling quarters. But he has been able to move that opinion to his side once he convinced him and elements in the foreign policy convinced folks that China did in fact represent a strategic threat as they see it. Then now they're in the process of galvanizing popular opinion to support their aggressive policies. We are opposed to any kind of Cold War with China or anybody else. We are linking up our work to close down AFRICOM with our concern with the Indo-Pacific command structure that's being aggressively militarized with the objective to complete the military encirclement of China. We say that when they talk about a Cold War, that translates those to hot wars for people on the ground in various parts of the world. So, you know, we are actively trying to educate our members and others on what is happening and to remind them that we have no interest in this fight, that this struggle between the U.S. bourgeoisie and China has nothing to do with the plight of workers and the laboring classes. And we are not going to allow one drop of our blood to be expended in the struggle. So we are educating folks, Michael. We had a webinar a couple of weeks ago with scholars that we participated in, with scholars from around and activists from around the world. They got significant coverage in Asia. In fact, the numbers were like crazy. We saw that we had over 100 million views of that webinar, Michael. 100 million. It's absolutely amazing. But, you know, for Asia, it is only average. You know, so we are actively building the capacity to resist this move. And we say no Cold War to China on China, and no Cold War or hot war against any other people on this planet.
Well, let's shift our attention a little bit westward, Ajamu, and talk about what the United States has done recently on the continent of Africa. Could you talk about the number of bases they have there, what their intentions are? And this is kind of a hidden recent history, isn't it?
It really is, Michael. I mean, we're looking at, on October 1st, the 12-year anniversary of the U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM. You know, there's been a tremendous expansion of the U.S. military footprint on the African continent that really began with the administration of Barack Hussein Obama. The intent is to use the U.S. military to basically recolonize the African continent using American military force. And I say recolonize, meaning that we're not suggesting that the African continent was ever really fully free of colonization. But because the U.S. sees a growing competition on the continent from China and is not prepared to engage in the kind of social investment, economic investment that the Chinese engage in, they use their only their resource, which is militarization. So they've been aggressively expanding themselves on the continent. There are dozens now of military bases on the continent. The largest base in the world, drone base in the world, is being built in Niger. And we see that there's U.S. commandos across the continent and military-to-military relationships between 53 of the 54 African nations and the U.S. So we are actively educating people on that reality and our opposition to it.
Jamu, we only have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask you how people can get in touch with the various organizations that you work with. You're a leader of the Black Alliance for Peace. That group is part of the Black is Back Coalition. You're a contributor to the excellent journalistic effort called Black Agenda Report. How can people get in touch with these organizations?
Well, thank you so much for that question, Michael. I would like to encourage everyone to go to the BlackAllianceForPeace.com to follow our work, to support our work. We put out a newsletter every week. Please come there. I write also for the Black Agenda Report. That's BlackAgendaReport.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Jamu Baraka. So, you know, we are building synergy. We are building opposition. And we hope that these efforts are supported by the public and that the information that we disseminate gets incorporated and circulated by the public because, Michael, we are, in fact, engaged in an information war.
Jamu Baraka, I want to thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder Radio. I wish you every success in your good work and invite you to come back on in the near future. So thank you again for being on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure. Looking forward for the next one.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.